different. So, don't get too comfortable.
Hi everyone, I'm Alan Money. I'm just kidding. My name is Stephen Downs, and I'm going to be up here on this podium only for a few moments. And with me, of course, are Darcy Norman and Brian Lamb. I'm just happy I remembered their names. And, well, we were thinking about what to talk about in this talk. We couldn't come up with anything. No, I'm just kidding. We're going to do something a bit different. So we've got topics that we cover, and you can see on the wiki some of the things that we talk about. But what we wanted to do is, instead of us being up here and broadcasting to all of you, we're going to leave the podium. We're going to be in and around, and you're going to give yourself your own keynote talk. And we're just going to heckle. So that's basically what we're going to do.
Actually, a good starting point would be
turning on the mic.
Turning on the mic, Bill.
So good.
How about now? Hello? Okay, let's talk loud. If you have a browser open, go ahead and fire it up and go to that wiki page. You can follow along. We've also got the Unkeynote chat, which is a web-based chat system we set up. So you guys, if you don't feel like standing in front of a microphone and, you know, heckling and comment, go ahead and comment there. We'll leave this up so we can actually follow through the back channel here. If you want to be anonymous, that's cool. We have some kind of names we don't know who you are. Lots of ways to give feedback.
And it's hard to hear you on that mic.
Brian, zoom in on the URL so we can see it.
Okay, the URL.
Go to the wiki and show the URL.
The URL is wiki.elearning.udc.ca/theunkeynote. That will take you to the page you see on the screen right now. And the Unkeynote chat is the link you would click on to join the chat room. Feel free also at any point to contribute. Just by flagging any one of us and taking the mic. These mics here are also live and set up, so you don't have to go through us at all. Don't feel like you have to stand on ceremony or formality. If you have a point, just get it out. This is the kind of defender thing. I also just want to say, maybe before we start, if everyone in the room could just introduce themselves, say where they are, especially the favorite sessions from the conference so far, and where they'd like to be in 5 years.
I'm doing it right now.
One thing that Stephen was actually talking about today, at the end of the day, we were talking about today sort of over lunch. Stephen was talking about how content is sort of becoming less and less important. It's more of how content is becoming less and less important, more about social interaction. Is anyone mics in the room?
You just want to know if you can break that one. Hello?
So the idea that social interactions are actually becoming, they've always been extremely important, but we're able to actually do some more interesting things with social interaction over distance, etc. So might be one interesting key idea.
Well, let's see if anyone has anything to say first about what we're doing so far. If nobody volunteers to say anything, I should pick someone at random. There we go.
What's the point?
The point is to be disorienting. Is it working?
Yeah, you got it.
When we were first talking about the idea that what would we do with that closing keynote, the one idea we all sort of came up with together is it would be really presumptuous for any of us to dictate to you what would be important. So the first thing we came up with was it would be very important for you guys to drive the keynote. What are the topics that you want to cover? What do you want to discuss? And what we were really hoping would happen, whether or not it happens or not, we don't know,
or what we were hoping would happen is that we enter into more of a discussion rather than sort of a talk-and-talk-based presentation. Again, trying to be disorienting, I know it seems kind of chaotic, but that's actually intentional, trying to draw in whatever we can, kind of draw you guys into the conversation. Yeah, and please grab the mic if you have something to say.
So I'm going to kick things off, hopefully getting the point, by putting the question out there with two words, collaboration and competition, and what that means for DL, distributed learning.
Anybody want to jump on that one? Collaboration and distributed distance learning? Wow, okay.
Well, I'd like to just follow up. What made you seize on the word collaboration? Do you want to understand what the true nature of collaboration is? Do we have collaboration?
I think one of the themes that have been threaded through the sessions I participated in and was highlighted in the ministry session this morning was the need to think collaboratively about the kind of work that we do. Rosina Smith's session yesterday had the same tone to it, and it's my observation that since the deregulation of distributed learning in 2002 that a lot of the events that have unfolded provincially here, and I think the same is true in Alberta, there has been a considerable amount of competition as well. Much of it healthy, but some of it damaging the opportunities for collaboration. So I think I feel that there's a mixed message, yet I also think I kind of get just not too sure where to go with it.
So is this a question of competition over resources, for example? We're supposed to be collaborating with one another, but for example, a lot of the grant application process, if you want to get additional funding, we end up competing with one another, or is that the question you're talking about?
No, I'm talking about funding for kids. I work at a DE school serving the 6 districts, and I'm aware of many of the high schools in my region that have not allowed their kids to enroll in distance education programs because distributing that kind of work means fewer jobs for teachers in their own district.
Yeah, I get that.
Well, does it though? I mean, one thing it might, and I know part of this, the conventional perspective on it would be using online distance, et cetera. Well, obviously you'll need to distance online, but I think, which actually is the same if not more teachers, but they get two different things. And the different thing, you can start to do more interesting things, I think. It also sort of gives the opportunity to sort of change the ownership of the relationship. And sort of what I guess we were trying to do here, maybe not work, sort of change the ownership of this relationship. If this isn't RCO, it's not your online course, et cetera. This belongs to you guys. The course belongs to the students. How the resources are allocated, that's a lot of how it works.
I think it's interesting how uncomfortable this is, this ownership change. Like even with us standing around in the room and needing the back, everybody's still looking at the front. It's kind of hard on the ego.
Well, this would be a dynamic that's very familiar to a lot of kind of constructivist environments in the sense you throw things open. There is kind of a sweet spot for structure. You do usually want to see things a little bit. People often want to have some sense of it. Those little bit of technical hiccups we had off the bat become amplified. Everyone who's ever taught in an online environment doing distance courses, that first initial wave of things where people are having trouble with their accounts, not knowing where to put their essay assignments, things like that, becomes all the more critical. Kind of reminds me of that dynamic.
Why am I just waving at any of us?
I was just going to ask Dan if he actually thinks that the competition is over resources, or is it that the bricks and mortar schools aren't allowing students to take distance education because they don't believe in it? They think it's a second class, second rate type of education.
No, I think it's over resources. At least that's the answer that's given to me when I query them. And now maybe it's hard for them to say something else. I don't know.
So here's my comment. I played in the K-12 sector, first of all, as somebody implementing technology for about 10 years. Then I now work at CCIT, responsible for implementing web-enabled services. I'm working on a PhD in educational technology, but I'm a parent. And I'm a parent of a kid enrolled in grade 9 in online learning. And I went to my neighborhood school, said I'd like to work on a program for my kid with online learning and some face-to-face learning. And they basically said, we can't help you. And only because I'm in the system and I knew Barry Carlin was in with me, was I, as a parent, able to figure out how to get my kid into an online learning program. So I think that there's huge possibilities here, but we're missing how to market this. There are lots of parents like me that are looking for other alternatives for their kids. We need to connect the services that are available here with the community of people that help make choices for this, and that's called parent community. Let's get our act together and make it easier to figure out what the difference is between open school, CTM online, Greater Vancouver Regional Education, distance education, and market this thing properly to those people that are acting on behalf of their kids, parents.
Well, I think one idea is sort of touching on there, again, it comes back to ownership. These various organizations that you're mentioning, they're coming from the top down. It's on some level of governmental mandate, this is an organization that we shall use to educate our kids. When really education is more about learning, and it has to come from bottom up. So is it these various organizations, or is it from the students, the parents, the teachers? And that sort of changed the whole dynamic in my head. How that would affect the institution and the schools, I have no idea. But essentially, I think along the idea of what really needs to change, to start to think differently about relationships, that will, I think, affect what you're starting to get.
The idea is that this is a problem and a solution that needs to go far beyond this room. The people that matter are the kids and the parents that are making educational decisions.
Here's a question. How many people in this room right now have their own blog?
That's pretty good.
It's, what, 30%, 40%?
That's the record.
Now, I want all of you, every one of you, send me the URL of your blog, send me something by email, or and
email to their chat. And for those of you who have wireless access, have the URL to your blog,
yeah.
Chat.
The rest of you, why don't you have a blog? Seriously. Because that is what I mean. And if you want a blog, it's really easy. Go, next time you're online, go to the website blogger.com, blogger.com. All the instructions that you have on blog is completely free.
5 minutes.
You can give them 5 minutes if you're slow. And then you can be talking to students, parents, anybody, instantly, online. You can be talking to the entire world online. And the question of publicity is no longer a question of getting them to do it for us. It's a question of us doing it for ourselves. One of the things that characterizes Frank and RC and I is that we didn't wait for the institutions to set up the structure for us. We went in there, we learned how to do it, and we just started doing it. We didn't ask, we just started doing it.
Well, at least I didn't ask at all about that. I didn't ask them before I said this.
Now, that is more or less the way it works. It's just a personal anecdote. The way I got to know Darcy was more or less through our blogs. So So I was blogging away in Vancouver, and I felt like at UBC, my job was pretty unique. At UBC, I didn't really know a lot of people then at UBC who were interested in what I was interested in. Actually, now there's a lot of people who are. 3-4 years ago, it was a little different. And I read Darcy's blog, he read my blog. We ended up collaborating with a third fellow named Dean down in Phoenix. And we had so much fun reading each other's blogs and kind of collaborating that way, we thought it might be fun to actually submit a joint conference application for a presentation so we could actually meet each other in person. And I'll never forget the day all the three of us actually all met one another. It was about 2 hours before our presentation that was actually set to begin. And I don't know if I've ever been so nervous about meeting people in my life, because these guys were absolute blasts to work with virtually. But of course, we always hear in the discourse, people have masks in virtual environments, they put on personas, it's not a real environment, and it detracts from face-to-face. And remember, that's fun, these guys in the virtual sense, really groovy, fun, smart, really into what I was into. And I remember being really nervous, well, maybe when we're actually in a face-to-face environment, you know, maybe I don't like these guys quite so much. But what I was really afraid of is they might not like me. And we hooked up, like I said, about 2 hours before the session, and the thought that reminded me of was meeting old high school friends that hadn't seen in 10 or 15 years. There were huge gaps in our face-to-face knowledge of each other and the way we related to each other. But there was also this really rich pool of shared experience and shared understanding. And as a result, I still see Darcy about once or twice a year, and we're very good friends. But when we see each other, there's no ramp-up time. There's no, what have you been up to for the last 6 months? The face-to-face in that virtual blogging environment, besides being a professional tool, that's been really beneficial, I think, to all of us. If we seem a bit evangelical, it's because we've really all enjoyed very tangible benefits. Not just warm and fuzzy benefits, but being able to collaborate with people. All of our careers have been enhanced by it. That's why we're suggesting you to this conference right now. We come by this evangelical fervor, honestly.
I'd like to go back a little bit to the concern that the bricks and mortar schools have about the online programs or the DL programs or whatever. And I think that whenever there's something that's different, it generates a discomfort or a fear or whatever. And I guess we are pretty scary because we are quite different in a lot of ways. But what I think the fear is that we're going to just have to get out of the school, and that we're somehow going to cost teachers jobs and certainly heard all those kinds of concerns that I have. What my experience has been has been quite the opposite, and that is that we have brought kids back into the school, and we work in cooperation carefully with the schools, and do create hybrid situations that it's a real win-win for everybody. We are offering programs to homeschool kids and kids who dropped out for a myriad of different reasons, and a lot of those kids have ended up tracking back into school, and I think that's an incredibly important message to get out there, that it's part of a continuum. And I think there will always be people who try to build those walls in between different levels of the organization. And we have to make sure that it's just fantastic communication to make sure that occurs. So, big thanks.
Just a short thought on the bricks and mortar schools as well, not had a good response to DL or open learning, they might just not know about it. It might just be sheer ignorance on the part of our schools that there's this ability to do some courses online.
Well, also, because it is different, just going back a few minutes ago when you guys sat down and realized that this is what was going to happen, yes, a little bit of discomfort. I mean, with it, a little bit of a risk doing something like this. At first, there's a lot of discomfort, a lot of, I'm not sure what's going on. But what I'm hoping is as this session moves on, for example, if you're getting more comfortable, some more dialogue going on, it becomes more interesting and known to you, maybe not for everybody, hopefully for most of you. The same thing might happen with the online learning and the blended learning. At first, it's introduced to school, huge discomfort. This isn't what I've done traditionally. I sit in a desk and look at a blackboard. But as it's introduced, you'll get more comfortable, more familiar, and it might actually help to change up things up. Maybe rather than maybe not, I don't know.
Like still not even here.
And part of the point too is you just slot the technology in and you see how it works, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And if it doesn't work, you go on to the next thing. I mean, no one knows how to do this. It's never been done before. giving a talk from the side of the room, even. Kind of unusual.
There's a question right here.
I think there's an interesting discussion going on, but I'm a new PL principal. I do a bunch of things. I mean, we're seeing a real growth in partnership with our high schools. We're no longer the owners of all the DL, the online content. We've got suites in every one of our high schools and evolutions of different levels. So to say that DE or DL has a monopoly on the service is not true. Regarding that, the lady's response to the back of the room, we've been doing combination programs with parents for years. It's gone off quite well, as long as we have some anticipation of that need, because of course we're still stuck in a staffing environment where we have to come up with enrollment in order to get the staffing we need to provide the service. So it's a bit of a challenge, but what we're trying to do, and one of the things I'm trying to do with my school district is grow the ability for every high school to have that service within the school, but also much globally outside the school and anywhere in the world. And it's getting there. And I think some of the work that was done prior to my getting there and the talent of our staff is certainly going to be easier.
I'm at the same school that Dan's at, and the issue is not within the district, it's cross-district, that we're taking students out of, we're a DE school, we're attached to District 8, and yet we service other districts in our region, and so what happens is there's this territorial thing. It's not a question of losing the students in the district from the high school to a DE situation or an online learning situation. It's a question of losing that student to a whole other district. And I think if we take a look at what might happen in the future, there's that possibility that kids can choose any district or any program throughout the province. And that, to me, is where the issue of collaboration and competition come in. Because all of a sudden, if you've got a principal or a superintendent in Vancouver and they're losing them to schools within the interior, is there going to still be that collaboration or will it become competition?
If they start to lose funding, if the students go somewhere else, they're going to be a little less incentivized to pursue a career like that. Something that might sort of impact that and how you set that, well, yeah, it's a separate school, I don't know. What might impact this? The goal here is not education with capital E, which is the infrastructure and schools and government organizations. The goal is learning. And that might happen in school, it might happen not on course. It should happen throughout your whole life. And the goal is how do we facilitate that in whatever we need to get students to be actually learning, and teachers and parents and everybody. How do you stop that? I don't know. I think it's bigger than a school or education issue.
I just wanted to say that I'm not convinced that the issue is one of bricks and mortar schools constraining the opportunity for kids to learn online or in an independent learning environment. It has far more to do with the funding mechanisms that are currently in place and the flexibility. And I think that with any kind of adjustments down the road, that could be opened up a lot. I think also, with the death of distance, really the question of where kids go to school, once more opportunities are provided, isn't really how I know. It's going to be the kids and their parents. And they're going to be looking for the best learning environments possible. Those could be hybrid environments. They could be independent learning environments, so they could be distance learning. I distinguish because I think online and distance is kind of an outdated term. So you consider the current technology and the ability of individuals to access information and work independently and in collaboration. So I just have never seen a traditional school kind of stand there as a barrier. Usually it's a barrier because the funding mechanism is a problem. But I think we delude ourselves if we think we are going to have a lot of control in the next few years about where students make the choice to go to school.
And that's certainly already happening now. I have a 16-year-old daughter who went to school electronically last year, and this year she's doing a combination of both, and the bottom line is students and parents flock to where the services are provided and where their need would be best met, regardless of whether funding is there or not, or they, you know, they will, once the door is open to them, they're going to be there.
I'm kind of actually wondering if we could shift the focus a bit from inside the province to outside the province. I'd be interested in the facilitator's perspective on how Canada, as a sequence of provinces or a federal state, is dealing with information technology for education compared to what kind of things that are happening in other parts of the world. And I think maybe we hear about what's happening in places like Australia and England, so we've got some comparative basis for that kind of assessment. So I was thinking PLEs, some of the stuff that's going on to just work in the UK at post-secondary level, certainly, but I think some of that could have implications for K-12 systems inside of us.
It's interesting, this came up in the text chat earlier, and he just referenced glue. Someone said in all caps, talk about glue! How many people are familiar with this term? I would expect fairly few, yeah.
Just a few.
Because it's a term that I don't even think existed in any way 6 months ago, and it's kind of a perversion, as far as I can tell, of some small startup company's web-based application. And Stephen ended up doing a hack off of that, and we've been talking about building some version of it at various events. But what are we talking about? We were talking about glue. First of all, how many people here know what RSS is? That's a really encouraging number. The HTTP definition stands for Real Simple Syndication. And the really simple version, it lets you do a couple of things. One thing it lets you do is it allows you to monitor a vast number of information sources in one place, usually through a personal RSS reader. And what this, the way this RSS reader works is, let's say you subscribe to 200 different sites. I could actually bring up my RSS reader.
No, I was just about to. What's the address?
You can just click on Blogline Feeds, actually. That'll do it.
Okay. Well, I want to switch windows. Blogline Feeds?
Yes. The key idea behind the glue is that it is able to pull in multiple decentralized sources of information. Okay, that's the way of saying, I read 500 different websites as a teacher. I might have 90 students through class of 30. They might all have their own blogs. So I want to go to each website and see what's new. This is the type of software that will pull latest posts of all of the bits of information into one place.
If you're not already using an RSS reader, just to explain what you're seeing here is, instead of going to 200 different websites, which may or may not have been updated since I last looked at them, and which may or may not be relevant to what I'm interested in, you can actually see through this kind of fairly standard sidebar menu. You'll notice that some of the sites are in bold text and some of them aren't. The ones that are in bold text have been updated since the last time I used this application. The ones that aren't in bold text have not. It's a very, very simple but very, very powerful information management strategy. Now, what you're seeing here is just a way of monitoring web logs, but the number of sources that have RSS feeds include pretty much every major news publisher in the world, more and more academic libraries. So for example, you can subscribe to your key subject classification for a library subject you're interested in, and when new items are added to the library under that collection, they get added that way as well. Now, so just to circle back to this idea of glue, pretty much every contemporary content management system or weblog system, when you publish a new item, will update an RSS feed much like you saw on the screen then. It's a very, very simple, very lightweight means of publishing materials. And it is actually trivially easy, has been for a number of years, to take those feeds and then render them someplace else.
So for example, just to give a very quick example again.
I'm just planning the session.
That was about as serious as we got. This sidebar here
is actually from my Delicious feed, so this is coming from a separate site. And if I add something new to that Delicious site,
I'll just get meta here and actually just maybe even add a new item right here. I'm bookmarking myself, click refresh, and already you can see that link was added there.
So imagine you have a classroom with 30 students web logging and other students are adding images to a shared database or whatever. When we're talking about glue, what we're talking about is how do we take all these small little pieces that are disparate out there? Okay, sure, we say you don't have to use the centralized content management system. You don't have to use the centralized course management system. Choose your own tools. Make it look however you want. Add your own images. Make it your own. But the idea of a personal learning environment where that individual section is, you empower the students to make those choices themselves, contribute the materials that they think would be relevant to that broader course aggregation element, and take it from there. So when that person on the tech stack said, talk about glue, and this person mentioned glue, what we're talking about is an effort, and Stephen actually developed an open source application that attempted to develop some of those things. Darcy, myself, and others have been talking about this a lot, is how can we allow people to use whatever tools they want, create environments for themselves that are meaningful for themselves, but still contribute to something that is meaningful as kind of a larger aggregate form that's not this totally decentralized distributed chaos where you never have any idea where anything's going.
Let's take this and apply it to schools. Think of a student in schools. Everybody has the assumption, and even some of the discussion so far, you know, one student, one school, or even one student, one teacher, one school, whatever. But with technology like this, and approaches like this, that goes by the wayside. And we begin to ask, why should we actually attach a student to a school? How does that make sense? Why not just have the student get whatever learning from whatever place is appropriate? And I know people are talking about institutional structures and funding and things like that. That's kind of why we're trying to mess up the structure here. We know it's a little uncomfortable, and it's really hard to break from that hole. But once you break from that hole, then you get past the idea that the school has to be the source of learning for that student. You flip-flop it around, and the student now begins to draw from the learning as appropriate. And that's what we want you guys to be doing here. So you've got three sources of learning, plus online, plus whatever, and we want you to draw from the learning resources as appropriate. And he's drawing from his cell phone right now. And that's good. We want people to do that.
Actually, as I said before, just drawing from the back channel as well. When people are in a brand new session, they're still feeling discomfort in the session. They've got a place to bed. If you're in a class, students could be having their own asynchronous back channel, talking, you know, asking questions, whatever, without disturbing other students. That's great. Sure, you guys can.
I just had a question for Brian. At UBC, you guys have been using blogs and wikis for quite a while now. In some pretty innovative ways. Can you give us a big wild story from this past winter?
Well, there's a few. I mean, I'll just maybe bring up my standard kind of page of examples, and maybe people can just look at some of the things people are doing on their own.
That wasn't really a good question.
Well, here's an example I like. Here's a professional development one. There's a librarian who's at Vancouver General Hospital, and he was kind of interested in this logging thing, but didn't see the point in doing it. So, have you heard of the Google Scholar Initiative? Essentially, Google digitizing huge academic libraries. It's a very controversial idea. It raised all sorts of flags around copyright and stuff.
Anyway, since it was a big thing in the library, he just decided to start a blog on it.
Now, the idea of the blog having to be a something where you're like intensely personal, you know, talking about your pain and your shame and all those sorts of things. There's none of that here. There's very, very little personal content here. He's really just copying news stories, offering a little bit of commentary. But what's interesting about this is he's gone from being kind of a junior library in a branch outlet of the UBC library system to being someone now who's invited to publish in major publications. He's being flown to places like London to give talks. He was just flown down to Microsoft as a consultant for their new academic search tool. This gives you a very, very simple idea of how a relatively simple web log, even one without much personal content, can be quite powerful.
Other examples. I don't know if this one's going to work.
This is kind of what we were talking about with the glue thing. You'll notice that on the sidebar here, each one of the students in the class maintain their own web log where they're expected to kind of maintain posts. This is on indigenous culture.
But by taking all these aggregated RSS feeds from the various individual sites, we can aggregate all of that individual content on those 30 separate sites and integrate it into something fairly tight. So this is something a little more managed environment, kind of about halfway between what you would see in one environment or another.
And to talk about something like wikis, I have lots of examples. Oh, actually, this is kind of an interesting case.
We have nothing to do with this. LiveJournal is an open web blog site, one of those ones you can go to start your own blog in about 5 minutes. I was really pleasantly surprised one day to find a reference to the UBC LiveJournal blog. Who is running this? I have no idea. Everyone who's involved is using a pseudonym. It's a bunch of students, actually now there's hundreds of people with accounts on this, and they are talking about things like being your honest friend. Has anyone experienced it? Is it as painful as they make it out to be? And they have quite honest discourse on these sites. Going to Thailand this summer, trying to get rid of my textbooks, the food at 99 chairs, whatever. What's interesting about this is, of course, not only that they did it on their own, and they don't need to go through a central service like the one we offer, what I find compelling about this is their need to have it outside. So there was one post not too long ago where he actually said, hey, we should start up a UBC, or we should start a wiki page so we can do stuff. You guys know what wikis are? So I saw that. I couldn't resist. I worked long enough. Just wrote in, hey, love what you guys are doing. Do whatever you want. But in case you don't know, we actually do host wikis. And you're welcome to use our system. And they immediately commented that, hey, thanks for the offer. Good on you to host wikis. But we just wouldn't trust a site that was hosted by UBC. We think it wouldn't have any legitimacy because there would be this implied notion of censorship and of limits. And I found that so delightful because, of course, I've been spending the last 3 years oftentimes listening to people saying that open wiki spaces where anyone can go in and edit anything in themselves lacks a sort of academic legitimacy. I love hearing that, and actually academic supported wiki itself wouldn't have legitimacy.
It doesn't have to go quite that far either. It's University of Hyder, I got a wiki running there. And even just a matter of opening it up and having control over to the individuals, we actually had a student plugin create faculty pages and templates. We actually created websites within our wiki for each of his faculty that he's enrolled in. He created a page for his linguistics club, and the club now organizes itself in the UConnery wiki. Amazing stuff. I didn't even know what was happening until I checked the change log. Hey, this guy's actually doing some interesting stuff. And so amazing things can happen, even just by turning over the keys to the car to see where we go.
And I noticed that at least two of you folks are from the full secretarial, so are you experiencing the same resonance from your staffs and colleagues? Yeah, I know you talk about those student wikis and things like that. So can you share some stories about the trials and tribulations when you get to the... I'm trying to think of my old math professor at BBC having a little wiki. So I'm sure you can start talking about that kind of...
Well, I had an interesting experience actually just yesterday. I was giving an introduction to podcasting workshop at the University of Calgary. There was 50 people in the session. There was like deans of faculties, you know, VIPs from the various IT departments, etc. We're talking about the technical side of things. This is how you record a podcast. You subscribe, you stick it on iPod, etc. And what 3/4 of the way through, a prophet was sitting in the back row raising his hand and says, okay, let me get this straight. See if I understand what's going on here. The technology is actually so easy that I can do this. And what I should be doing is spending my time thinking about what I'm going to do in the classroom. And yes, exactly. This is the point where you can do this, your students can do this, and you should be thinking critically about what you're doing in the classroom. And hearing him say that, rather than me preaching, which I feel like I'm doing it all the time, getting my head against a brick wall, but now that his idea, hey, this is easy, right? I should be thinking about rethinking how I teach. And that kind of thing is starting to happen, but I feel like the last few years I've been banging into a brick wall, because a lot of these ideas, I mean, again, just think back to how you felt when you first sat down in this room, what the hell is going on here? There's a lot of that, a lot of discomfort. And that is starting to change as people see examples. As, you know, some of the people, there are professors, there are teachers in K-12. One of my family friends, actually, is a teacher at a private school in Calgary. And he uses the Wikipedia religiously in class, not as the authoritative resource, but to teach literacy to his students. They did an assignment on Pearl Harbor last year. And as they were reviewing the page, they realized that it said Pearl Harbor was invaded by the country of Montana, and grossly wrong information.
And so they wound up with this amazing discussion about, well, what is authority? What is valid content? How do you check sources? Things that wouldn't have been part of this curriculum had you not been using these chaos anarchy resources as part of what he did. So.
You got someone over here.
Or Klaus Kiel, IIT technology, and the students actually requested the release. It wasn't so much me. The students were coming to us and saying, let's be fluid on campus as a whole. And what happened was the students started asking for some of the features of fluid. They were there or off. And we please have the wiki here in ours, and we please have this here in ours, and we free the functions are on. And then they were here to check it. So we could talk about wiki had vulnerabilities, and wiki had issues, and we could. So the students actually drove us to put some fluid in our center.
And that's actually accelerating too. And we've been preaching these ideas for feels like years now. And it's to the point now where professors, faculty, and students are starting to come to us. We want to have blogs on campus. And I can finally say, we've been doing that for a couple of years. Here's the evidence. And it's starting, it's not like that'll be the watershed moment, but the level of comfort is getting there, we're actually starting to get some input.
I'm teaching an online course, and we tried to convince our boss to use a blog, and his answer was, well, I can't use the word track changes, so you can't use a blog. And then when we pushed him a little further, he said, but other people can respond on the blog, and it's open to everyone, and I have no way of knowing how the work is your work, so sorry, you can't use a blog. So.
Current process of redesigning our department's website. I work at the Teaching and Learning Center. And I was preaching, let's do the whole thing in Drupal. It's this great community plumbing website. We have forums and discussions and blogs and all that stuff. And somebody piped up and said, well, what did somebody post a comment negative about our department? And I thought, if they have something negative to say, shouldn't we listen to that? Isn't that valid? And but they wanted, you know, there's a way for us to remove negative comments. And I think we're actually moving away from that. But that is definitely a valid comment. If I put my course online, then anybody can comment. What is somebody comment? Oh my god.
Hi there. The thing I wanted to say about Wikipedia is I think often we think for students, it's for the excellent students. I mean, with Wikipedia and other sites like that, it, for the students that don't do as well, the information is there. It's very simple. It's very comprehensive, and it's something that they can go through very quickly and read through. And then the relational part of it is if they get interested in one thing, then they link on to the other thing, and then they see all of that. So I think that's really good. You know, not the, you know, kids who are really excelling, but what if just kids who are, you know, just wanting to think or something, you know?
Yeah, that's the whole level of concernativity. You used to go to the library, going down the bookshelf, you're looking for, you know, book number 47.42, and 47.43 is kind of interesting too. You're trying to get that now with the wiki and the long haul. You're looking for something, but the stuff that's next to it on the shelf is kind of cool too. And you can actually walk down and find stuff that you wouldn't have gotten to. So serendipity is a very cool thing for that.
If I could just jump back to the comment about the weblog used at the university and whether or not it's going to be acceptable. Negative comment. As a coordinator of technology in the K-12 environment, a lot of secondary school teachers want to use blogs to try and get discussion and communication going in their classes, especially more senior levels. And a big concern that comes up from teachers is whether or not students are making appropriate comments or use foul language or any of those kind of things. And that's significant fear for them. One of the things that, for some of our lead teachers who are using blogs in their classroom, one of the things they say is, well, I informed the students right at the beginning that your blog is, this is public, and that I'm giving the address away to all of your parents, and I'm giving the address away to all the other, so you get kind of a distributed authority around what's appropriate, as opposed to having that authority centralized in one person who's going to police everyone else. And that distributed authority, in that if there was someone in the community who was behaving inappropriately, they would respond. And then, so that creates a kind of, you give away the need for you to be in control of whether every single word that's spoken or added into the environment is going to be appropriate, because now you've got how many sets of parents and school administration and everybody else is going to be keeping a pretty close eye on it because it's new and it's different. And that distributed sort of sense of control, or not control, but policing or concern or whatever else is a way of maintaining that safety.
Kind of like in a family, it takes a village to teach a student.
Exactly.
It's not unlike the way that supervision might occur in a public park with a set of parents all in the playground. You can wander away and not watch your child every second of every day if you're in a trusted network of peers who are all watching the kid.
But I've worked in a district that's had pretty good technology for a long time. And see from your comments just now about parents looking at these things. I live in rural D.C., and frankly, many of the parents are lost about laws rather than laws. And they talk about quickies rather than quickies. So I'm seems to my concern around this. You had mentioned that it's taken you many years at university to work with a professional community, a mature community, a literate community to have these things happen. In our reality, not because I don't believe in the value of this, but our reality is somewhere different than that. And I wonder if you could suggest some ways or ideas that you have about how we actually grow a little more. Because in education, as is pointed out throughout this world, we're behind where you are.
Actually, I would dispute that notion of whether you're behind or not. I forget who said it earlier, but in many respects, if you look at the actual innovations happening on the ground and look at examples of, say, individual teachers doing really cool stuff with small technologies and kind of relatively unsupported environments and doing real innovation, there's actually far more examples of that happening in the K-12 space from what I can tell, especially in rural areas. I mean, I think there's an element of necessity bearing that out. I don't dispute what you're saying, and I don't think we can take it on ourselves to buy ourselves make, you know, huge broad-based change happen across those cultures. I think all you can do is do the best you can for yourself and try to model some of that change. You see instances of encouraging developments happening, to throw your support behind it, knowing that there will be days when things seem to go wrong. You know, one of the things that's definitely happened, you know, with stuff you used to get great days, and the worst, I'll come and I'll see something on the wiki that, you know, some, like every day, someone creates a new page, but I have no idea where they are, where they come from, or what they're doing. All I know is what they're doing is really beautiful. And but at the same time, there are risks involved. There are server crashes when you have 35 people phoning you who you didn't even know existed desperately trying to get their data back. This is new. We're all figuring this out. We're all kind of, you know, in dimly lit rooms, stumbling about and skimming our knees on coffee tables. So the kind of concerns you're articulating are absolutely valid. I guess all I can say in response to myself is I look back on where stuff like this was happening 3 years ago, and I look at the kind of discussions that we're having in this room right now, and kind of points that people are making across the table, and how many people nod at things that would have seemed quite radical even 3 or 4 years ago, and just had seen change happen, and just, you know.
I just want to add to the other reality. I was doing a session pretty much like this, except with fewer people and more organized. in Edson, Alberta, and Edson is another one of the rural places. And one of the groups participating in the session by video conference, in a small town in rural Alberta, they decided to look up their local school, and it turns out that the bulk of their senior class is on MySpace, and that they're already there. It's quite surprising because the teachers are. This is already happening. Most of your students are on MySpace or one or the other social network, or they have their own blog or their live journal or whatever. This is already what's happening. And everybody's talking about, I was talking about this earlier to Garrison and Brian, everybody's talking about what. Well, how can we get blogs into education? How can we get social networks into education? How can we get wikis into education? But it's the other way around. These people are already living in that world. And the challenge for us is, how do we get education into blogs? How do we get education into wikis? How do we get education into social networks? It's no longer the case that they're coming to us. We have to go to them.
A point that relates to that. People talk a lot about the digital immigrants and the digital natives and how students on a technical level intuitively grasp this stuff. But anyone who's spent time with kids doing stuff with technology, as for all their technical sophistication, I'm often quite shocked at their degree of grasp of the implications of what they're doing. For example, knowing that something they put on a public web space could be discovered and verified by other people. As Steve was talking earlier, you know, we talked a great deal about, you know, the way kids will post stuff on a public web page of themselves engaging in dangerous behaviors or revealing quite dangerous things about themselves. Came across a site of someone, an anonymous young teenage web blogs with eating disorders, and they were talking in group with great candor about themselves in a public setting. And when someone linked to that, as an example of somebody kind of revealing themselves on the web, were shocked to find that a stranger would not only see their website, but link to them and direct other strangers to them, seemingly unaware of what publishing in a public web environment was. It was a beautiful website, well-designed, sophisticated, well put together, and all those things. And again, that's a role educators are going to have to take on whether we want to do it or not, because the kids are there.
Yeah, recently I did a search on actually throughout BC and then also for Canada, just to look at how we were dealing with authorized user policy or with the ethics and morals of information. I was asked by a company in Japan because they were looking at that, not from their Ministry of Education, but from their industry, because their industry had a certain kind of apprehension about what they were doing and what the effects were, the long-term effects. And it was interesting when I started looking around, what I found was actually one of the best sites is actually put out by Industry Canada called CyberWise. And our own policy here in BC dates back to 96. If you take a look at what we're using something that was generated by the library group back several years ago. And so those are really important issues. In terms of like what's happening and how they're being used and how our kids being informed. And something we probably should be looking at and building into our new standards that we're coming up with.
One more here.
Oh, I just had a challenge with the area of the BCS online people for next year to provide an environment like that for the whole conference. And I see all kinds of people with laptops, and I know they're taking session notes and stuff that nobody else is going to see but them later. People are using Word. Let's get something up online where people can collaborate around what's happening at a conference like this.
But Jerry, you don't need conference to play that.
I know.
That's the whole point.
We do for that maybe, but. Okay, we do need to wrap up here. The audio from this session will be available. I guess there are conference things. Where it's available. I've also been recording it. I'll have it up on my own website probably in an hour or two, so if you want to hear it all again. Or hear it for the first time because you're reading email, that will be available. I don't know, this is our first time using this chat system, so I think we'll try to capture that chat, and so we'll try to make that available as well. It's a good point, though. You create your own tracks, you create your own resources. We've just created, all of us together, have just created a really spectacular online learning resource right now by ourselves. And we did it for free, more or less for free. Well, right there is that. And we're going to put it up online, and it will be available for free for everyone else in the world. And that's how you do this. You don't depend on the funding, the support, and we will make this happen for you. You do it yourself. I think that's the note in which I want to close. Perhaps you really want to say something.
I'd just like to thank the organizers for allowing us to inflict this unstructured analogy, and thank you to the participants for your trust and your wonderful contribution.
And for sitting in the room.
We also have a few more announcements and, of course, the iPod tour.